Hi, I'm Nick.
And I'm Jess.
And this is season two of Turn On Your Monitor, where we basically had the idea that we are going to podcast about a topic until we get burnt out on it. And then we're going to pick a new topic, and then that will be the change of seasons. So we had a little bit of a break where we were, you know, figuring out the state of the podcast and the state of things. And so we have a new idea, a fresh idea for season two. And basically the plan right now is that we're going to talk about every week, we're going to talk about a different music documentary, which is not that far out of bounds of what we talked about before, because I think, you know, some of our more popular episodes so far have been Woodstock 99 documentary, Beatles Get Back. You know, we've talked about Clapton, we talked about the bad CBGB movie. So we've talked about this stuff a lot before, and we figured that this would be a way to talk about two things that we enjoy, which is music and cinema, and to avoid talking about some of the other stuff that we're kind of burnt out on and not particularly excited about right now. A lot of the tech bro stuff and COVID stuff, kind of really burnt out on that right now. So we're going to be picking a different music documentary every week to talk about. But get this. And I haven't dropped this one on you yet. So, name of the podcast, Turn On Your Monitor. We're obviously thinking computer monitor, whatever. But what do you call the fold-back speaker you use to hear yourself when you're performing music?
A monitor.
That's right. Name still fits. And you might not be able to do it yourself, but you could tell the sound person to turn up, down, or even on your monitor. So count it. Name still works. still a perfectly sensible name for the podcast that, for the time being going forward, is going to be us talking about movies about different musicians and bands. Which brings us to, would you like to introduce our film for the day?
Yes. Today we're going to be talking about the documentary Metallica, Some Kind of Monster,
which was released in 2004.
Yes, a while ago.
Yeah. Just general, like, couple words. How do you feel about this documentary?
Honestly, I had to take a break in the middle of it. It was kind of a slog. But also, really? Yeah, but also, I mean, it's funny. I wish it was shorter.
I think that violates the ethos of Metallica, which is just like too much all the time. Cause, like, okay, so here's the thing. I really, really enjoyed this, and I don't care even a little bit about Metallica. Mm-hmm. Like, I know we touched on this in our Woodstock 99 episode, but I'm not a Metallica listener. I've never been. I mean, like, I've listened to Kill 'Em All a couple times because it's kind of lo-fi and weird. But like, I've never listened to another Metallica record all the way through. Like, I'm not a Metallica person. It's kind of almost the antithesis of what I want when I want heavy music.
Yeah.
But I think this documentary is hilarious, and I think that it's hilarious because of the excess, which I guess we'll get into. As a setup, what is the story behind how this documentary happens? How would you set that up?
It's early 2000s. I think they're filming this. It's like 2000. Is it 2001 or?
Yeah, it starts around 2001.
Right. So picture it. The Twin Towers have fallen. No. Metallica just sued Napster. Everyone hates them. Their fans hate them. They need to come up with a new album. And I don't know if we were kind of talking about this before the episode, if their bassist, Jason Newsted, had quit just prior to the documentary. He quit like at the beginning of them filming the documentary. Yeah. So they're out of bassist. There's only three of them. They've hired a $40,000 a month executive therapist, like a sports therapist, like kind of performance therapist kind of guy. And they're working on this. They've decided to film a documentary about this entire process.
I'm trying to wrap my head around what they were intending this to be when they started out, because I feel like it became a very different documentary than they were thinking it was going to be.
I don't know what they thought it was going to be.
Okay, so here's what I think. hey, Metallica's back in the studio making a new record. They're going to go in there and make that record. They don't know. They don't know that Hetfield's going to go to rehab for a year. They don't know that Newsted's going to quit. Like, they don't know that stuff's going to happen. So I feel like the documentary was supposed to take place over like 6 months, and then it became this just drawn out thing over years.
Yeah, they take over 2 years to film this.
It's funny, near the end, you start getting like the day counters where it's like day 681.
Yeah, I think into 700 and something. They're still filming.
Yeah, by the time, because they start filming in 2001, the album comes out 2003, and then the documentary comes out 2004. I don't know. I think it's fascinating just because, like you were saying, it's like too much.
Yeah. But
everything about this band feels like too much because, like, all their albums are too long. The documentary is too long. Everything is too much. And it's really funny as like a portrait of these guys who they don't seem to think that they're like these like weird elite high society people. They're like, oh, we're just like normal guys. And then it just keeps cutting to them doing like the most insane rich person shit.
Right. And like, I know I said it was too long, but I also don't know what I would, if I was faced with editing this, I don't know what I would cut out.
I mean, the thing that strikes me when watching it is that it's too much for one documentary, but like, what choice did they have? Like, it was supposed to be the documentary of the making of an album. But through the course of filming that documentary, it becomes a documentary about Hetfield going to rehab and then coming back and then trying to get back into the groove in a new, doing his new sober lifestyle. And it simultaneously becomes also a documentary about a band losing a longtime bassist and having to replace that member while recording that. Like, there's like multiple different documentaries within the documentary.
Right.
Like, so much is going on.
And it's also a documentary about their therapy sessions with Phil, yeah, the therapist.
Yeah. Honestly, Phil's kind of the MVP of this because I don't know why they thought it was a good idea to, like, okay, sure, maybe getting an expensive therapist who, because they say that they met him through another band that was under their management. So some other band that's managed by the same people was working with him, and they were like, oh, this seems like a good idea. And like you said, he's a very expensive therapist who works with like sports teams. And I guess like anytime you have like a bunch of rich, egotistical assholes who have to work together for the success of a greater organization. But they decide to film it. Like, they film them all being in like what is essentially like band couples therapy.
Yeah. And it's mostly therapy between, like the problems mostly seem to be between Lars Ulrich and Hetfield. Like, Kirk Hammett is just like a chill guy who's sort of there. At one point, he says, he kind of talks about, I guess he must be Buddhist or something. He kind of talks about it, even if he isn't, he seems very influenced by that. Because he says at one point, he says something about trying to be an example of egolessness to the other band members.
Yeah, he's like very chill. And like, he's also very commonly like, he's just kind of in the corner and everyone's kind of ignoring him the whole time. Like,
yeah,
because a big part of the recording of the record was like, hey, let's no guitar solos. And Kirk's like, what? What do you mean no solos? Like, yeah, no solos. So they kind of box them out of that. And then, you pointed out when we were watching it the other day that when James gets back from rehab, he's like, and part of his rehab schedule is like, he's not working like super long hours. Like, he has like a 4-hour window every day to do it. It's like part of his recovery. So they're kind of like trying to figure out how they're going to like record this album while also, you know, he's only available for part of the day. And he said that he was worried that like he would go home and then everybody else would be like working without him. And he'd come in to find that like they've all decided things without him. And Kirk's just kind of like, that's how it's been for me the past 15 years. And then they just steamroll over. They just
ignore it. Yeah.
Like,
they
Phil
just totally ignore it.
Phil jumps in just like completely ignoring that comment and just going right back to talking to James. Maybe we should segment it up. I don't know, because there's so many like little things I want to talk about. but I don't know how to organize them all yet. Like, I want to talk about Lars's dad. I want to talk about their ridiculous cutaways to their opulent lifestyles. I think maybe to set the scene of all of this, it should be noted that while we are not Metallica fans, this documentary takes place while they're recording what many Metallica fans consider to be one of, if not the worst albums they've ever made, Saint Anger, which
yes.
I actually yesterday listened to in its entirety, the completely overly long, like I was talking about Metallica with Excess. The album is like an hour and 15. Like, it's they filled the CD completely full, and every song on there is like 6, 7, 8 minutes long. It's very monotonous. Like, it all blends together into like one big mush in my head. Like, it's not at least like with the earlier Metallica stuff, like where there's like Enter Sandman or One or whatever. There, like, there's moments that break it up, and like there's some like iconic riffs and like there's some like acoustic parts and stuff, but Saint Anger just felt like I turned it on and it was just like, it was like, do, 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 with that horrible snare sound. And it just kind of,
it's famous for that, right? Like, it is famous for the terrible snare sound.
Yeah, it's notorious for the snare sound, and people have tried to figure out what was going on, which,
why did they do that?
Okay, so this is one of the things that, like, I guess the documentary wasn't focused on. It didn't really focus so much on, like, the
actual making of the album.
Well, it didn't get into, like, the specifics. Like, it didn't get into the specifics of anybody, like, figuring out why the tones were going to be like that. And you can kind of, if you know how the album was put together, you can kind of piece it together. But there's not really, like, a very explicit focus on the actual recording process. But the idea of the album was it was supposed to be raw. And they mention it in the documentary that it's supposed to sound like a band got together to jam in a garage, but that band is Metallica. So it's supposed to be kind of rough around the edges, which, first of all, that's completely off the mark because they recorded the whole thing in Pro Tools. Like, my understanding of the album recording is that they just had these freeform jams and then they chopped it up in Pro Tools and looped stuff and like recorded over it. So it's like the least organic way you could make a rock record. But the idea was it was supposed to be really rough and kind of ugly. So for some reason, Lars disengaged the snares on his snare drum, and that's the snare sound. It's just a sound that, like, you know, people do during drum solos, or if you're playing with brushes, or like in reggae, they'll do. Like, there's uses for that sound, but usually if you're whacking it with a stick hard for a heavy metal record, you're not going to do that. So I don't know why, but that was the sound of the record. Like, they felt like it was like Lars felt it was an important part of the sound of the record that it have that, which everybody hates to the point that it's become a meme. You know, people have covered other Metallica songs from different eras and they put the Saint Anger snare in. People have taken Saint Anger songs and dubbed the sound of a trash can being hit over the snare. There was like a, I saw like I. If you watch like any of these on YouTube, you start getting recommended a ton of Saint Anger memes. But there's one where like somebody was like, what if every drum was the Saint Anger snare? And like he tuned the snare to different pitches for like the toms and like overdubbed the set that he was playing along with. There's a million memes and stuff for it. But the basic answer was that for some reason he wanted it to sound ugly and they picked the horrible snare sound and that's the sound. And yeah, the production on the album is like, I don't know, it's like really... It's like that. It's like really Loudness Wars victim where like everything's overly compressed. It's really ugly. Nothing stands out. It's really monotonous. There's no guitar solos to break it up because they didn't want guitar solos.
Yeah.
The lyrics are really like every time I focus on the lyrics are really bad. Like,
they're really bad. And I don't know that Metallica was ever lyrically great, but
I don't consider them out. Yeah.
They seem bad. Even for Metallica.
Yeah, well, so from, once again, they're not super clear on this, but it sounds like they did the thing, which I don't know if this has ever, like, this is one of those things, it's the Tobias Funke quote of, like, has it ever worked for people? It's like, no, people delude themselves into thinking it'll work, but it might work for us, where you say, hey, we have a guy in the band who writes all the songs. What if instead we have all the other people who don't write songs? What if we have them write songs? And like probably the only time that has ever worked is when The Who did it, because what happened was the other guys flaked out, didn't write material, there wasn't enough, and then Pete Townsend was like, oh shit, what do I do? And they're like, I write a really long opera, I guess. Like, that's the only time it's worked out, because it failed. But every time a band has tried to do that thing where you say, like, hey, you guys don't write songs for this, it never works out. But it seems like that was what was happening, because they're like, no, for the first time, we were invited into the process. Like, Kirk's writing lyrics and Lars is writing lyrics, because they said, like, early in the days, it was like Lars didn't comment on James's lyrics. James mm-hmm. didn't comment on Lars's drumming, because, like, they would butt heads. So it was like, you stay in your lane, I'll stay in mine. But they're all kind of sitting around with notepads writing about their feelings.
Yeah.
To get, like, these ideas out. And you end up with stuff that's like, frantic, tick, tick, tock, tick, tock, tick, tock, tick, tock. My lifestyle determines my death style. Yeah. My lifestyle determines my death style. Dong, 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 dong with the snare. I'm madly in anger with you. I'm madly in anger with you. Oh, yeah. Madly in anger with you. And it's like, invisible kid. Ignore the ways on away. Invisible kid. most of the rest of that record kind of blends together for me. But like, yeah, anytime I focused on the particular lyrics, they were pretty rough. And yeah, so like, the lyrics are bad. The production's bad. The music's not really that good. It feels very lifeless. It's not a good record. Like, I listened to the whole thing, and I am never going to do that again. It's not like bad in a fun way. It's just kind of like really generic and samey. But throughout the process of this documentary, it seems like they think they're making a masterpiece.
Yeah.
Like, Lars is in the studio. He's like, this is going to be so good. And he's talking to, were they talking to their manager, maybe?
I think so. Yeah.
The guy from Q Prime, who was like, think about it, you're going to be in a stadium. People are going to be throwing devil horns, chanting Metallica, Metallica. And Lars is like, this is going to be so cool.
Yeah.
And like, they're working on like Saint Anger. And it's like, yeah, this is not going how you think it is. But yeah, so that's the backdrop to this entire documentary, is that they're working on, I think there's some debate. I think that some people say like, Death Magnetic is worse, probably. Like, there's some debate over which is actually the worst one, but like, Saint mm-hmm. Anger's in the running. Although, as an aside, I was working on music right before this, and I loaded up this kind of like mastering compression plugin. There's a preset in there that's just called Death Magnetic, where if you turn it on, it like brick walls the entire mix to shit. Like, it's the it's everything cranked up to 10 on that plugin is called the Death Magnetic plugin, because that's,
oh my god,
that's one of the albums that's like most infamous for being a loudness war casualty of just being brick walled to shit and unlistenable. But yeah, so that's the backdrop of these guys are in the studio for years making one of the worst records ever made, thinking it's good. So that's kind of part one. So during this, their longtime, not original bassist, but longtime bassist, Jason Newsted, quits, because in Metallica lore, they're young. They have a guy named Cliff Burton who's like, he's one of those guys, like, you know, he has it all set up where like, he's gifted and he's kind of like the soul of the band, and he's like writing cool stuff, and he dies very young. So like, you kind of instantly get legend status at that point. Mm-hmm. And he dies like very early on. So at this point, Jason Newsted has been bassist with them for like 20 years. So he's like a pretty established member of Metallica at this point. And he quits to go do his new band.
What was his band called?
Echo Brain.
Echo Brain, yeah.
I guess he was feeling like Metallica was stifling him, because he was like, I could do this other band too. And Metallica was like, no, you're in Metallica.
Right, that was the impression I got, was that James was kind of like, no, you're in Metallica, that's it, you can't do your own shit.
Maybe this was like a retrospective thing of him like shitting on them now that he was not in the band, but he kind of was like, this whole group therapy thing is cringy as hell, I'm out, we don't need this crap. Yeah. I'm gonna go do Echo Brain. Which, when I watched this originally, the first time I watched it was a little while ago, I skimmed around. Echo Brain only put out one record. Mm-hmm. I think a couple EPs, but they put out one LP. I skimmed around it, and it's like, it kind of feels like they made a 90s record like a decade too late, I would say. But part of the narrative of the documentary is that like, Metallica is like, oh shit, Echo Brain's popping off, Fuck.
Yeah. They're genuinely worried that Echo Brain is going to be the next big thing.
Like Echo Brain, everyone's going to be wearing Echo Brain shirts, and Metallica's going to be nothing. Yeah. Which history kind of it didn't quite happen that way. I had never heard of Echo Brain before mm-hmm. watching this documentary. There are some people who are like, "Oh, Echo Brain, underrated band that should have been bigger," but yeah, they didn't really do much. Newsted's played with like some other, like he's played bass for like a couple other people and did the cringy thing that all rock stars do where he thinks he's a painter and now he's like a painter, and
yeah,
it's a horrible thing. But yeah, so Newsted quits. So they're in the even better position of now they're trying to record an album without a bassist. So for that whole record, their producer, Bob Rock, he fills in on bass with them. So
Bob Rock is one of the great rock names.
Yeah, I mean, if you're gonna be a rock producer, you might as well have a name like Bob Rock. Let me actually look up what's his real name.
I think his name is Rock.
Robert Jens Bob Rock. Okay, if your last name is Rock, you kind of have to get into rock.
Yeah,
but he'd worked with Metallica a bunch before. He'd worked with like a lot of rock bands. From what I'm seeing in the documentary, I'm not very impressed with his production skills.
No.
Because if I was the producer of this record, there were like 50 individual moments where I would have been like, hold up, let's maybe rethink some of these decisions that are sounding like shit.
Like, yeah.
I mean, like it's the, on a big record like that, it's the producer's job to be like, hey, I know that your whole thing is that you want the snare to sound bad, but let's absolutely not do that. It's going to sound like shit.
Yeah.
We have an hour plus long record and the entire time is like bonk, 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 bonk. But like the whole time he's blowing smoke up their asses. He's like, this is gonna be such a good record. Oh, this is gonna crush. Yeah. So he's kind of one of the villains of the film in my view, because he was the one who had a lot of power to stop this, and he doesn't.
Right. And I do think they seem to listen to him. Like it doesn't seem like a thing where they're just disregarding anything he says. That like he's kind of enabling them and being kind of a yes man to them.
Yeah, and he's like, yeah, this idea, let's go. Yeah, it sounds great. This is gonna be so heavy. Like, in no, it's
not.
No, it's not a good idea. Like, you should intervene. Like, honestly, if I was producer, I'd be like, yeah, this whole like jam for 30 minutes and then chop it up in Pro Tools thing, this is bullshit. Like, let's absolutely not do this. Because I think he produced like the Black Album. Like, he produced some of like the well respected Metallica ones.
Yeah,
which. I don't know. Those are also in my, like, a lot of people love the production on those. I also think they're overproduced, but I like
the Black Album a lot when I was a kid. So, I mean, I have no hate for it, but yeah.
He's worked with them on records that Metallica fans love and love the sound of. So the potential should be there to do that again. Yeah. And the answer would be to not do any of the stuff they tried to do on Saint Anger, because it was all, it feels like every decision they made was the wrong one. Like it's kind of a very George Costanza record, because every time they were presented with a choice, they made the wrong choice. In my estimation, having sat through that record,
it is like, I do wonder if some of it is just that they worked on it too long. I mean, they were working on it for I don't know how long before Hetfield went to rehab, and then you had a whole year where he was out of the band. Like, they didn't even know if Metallica was going to be a band still.
Yeah, there's like a solid year where he's off in rehab. They don't know if he's there. Newsted's already quit, so it's right. Like,
yeah, so they're down a member, and then they're down they're one of their most important members.
Yeah, I mean, I'm gonna say if anybody can't be replaced in Metallica, it's the front man.
You really can't replace him. So yeah, he's gone. He's not talking to them. They don't know where he is. No idea. Yeah. And then by the time you get back to working together, I do wonder if it's just like, okay, whatever, I'm tired. We like, great. If you're Bob Rock, are you just like, okay, whatever, it sounds great. Like,
I mean, it should have been,
get this over with.
It should have been one of those records where they scrapped it and just started over, because they didn't mm-hmm. have any, like, they didn't have anything. They didn't have any fully formed songs. They didn't have vocals for anything. Like, they didn't have anything when he came back. They should have been like, all right, let's start over again. Like, it's been.
Yeah, that's what I would have done. I mean, I think I would have replaced my bassist and then
They should have done that first.
Because, yeah, I don't want to get ahead of ourselves, but when they do replace the bassist, I feel like they got a kind of new lease on life as a band.
So I've heard that the CD, I don't know if it was like a permanent thing or if it was like a special edition or like a first edition kind of thing, but if you bought the St. Anger CD, it came with a DVD of them like playing the whole album live with their new bassist, and everyone was like, oh, I just listened to that instead of the album because it sounds better.
Right.
Like, it sounds more energetic. The snare doesn't sound like shit. Like, it's just a better thing. Which, I mean, honestly, if they wanted to just be it, like, if they wanted to sound like a band in a garage, they should have just fucking done the, like, the Albini method of you just put the band in a room and you have the band play the songs and then you have the song. Like, if that was their intention, maybe it's because of the way the bass is mixed, but I didn't get the impression that Bob Rock was really adding anything as a bassist on that record.
No, not at all.
When I listened to it, there was nothing particularly interesting going on bass-wise. Like, I get the sense that he was just there to, like, I'll play the roots so that the song has a bass. Whereas, like, I don't know if that's necessarily the most interesting. Like, you should have got a bassist before you recorded the record.
They really should have.
It really would have been a much better choice. It would have resulted in a better record.
It was kind of weird that they didn't. But, and like, you see, there's a scene where Bob Rock is saying, I don't think you guys will ever have a permanent bassist again.
Yeah, he's like, after Cliff, you know, there's no way you can have a permanent bassist after Cliff, which is like, all right, that's kind of weird. That's kind of weird.
That's
some toxic behavior on Bob Rock's
part. It was kind of toxic. And he's kind of weirdly nagging them about their dead bassist and they'll never be able to replace him. And I'm also like, is this just a gambit to become a permanent member of Metallica? Like,
yeah, that's the thing where it's like, I don't know. Is it like he trying to like...
I guess I'll do it forever because you'll never find anyone.
Yeah, just let me play bass in the studio. Every clip of him in the documentary where he's playing bass is like, and he knows where the notes are, but he's like not doing anything with it. He's not doing like a Cliff Burton or a Trujillo style. Like, he's not doing that on bass.
No, yeah, he's really not. And even when they do a fan appreciation day and they kind of have a, you know, you can play bass with us and jam out, like the people in that would have been better than Bob Rock.
Yeah. I mean, honestly, a dedicated and skilled Metallica fan probably could have pulled it off better. I mean, that's basically, I mean, I don't know how many times that's happened before, but I mean, that's basically how the Chili Peppers got John Frusciante. Was like, hey, here's this kid who's obsessed with us who can play all our songs. Let's just get him to do it.
Yeah.
So the backdrop of all this is the recording of one of the all-time most infamously bad records of all time. And at the start, when they first jump into this project, one of my favorite parts of this is just how like out of touch, like how much out of touch rich guy shit they do. Because like they keep doing talking heads of the band, like talking about like their feelings and the band and blah, blah, blah. But like they're all insane because it's like they'll cut to Kirk, who's like, he's surfing and he's like, oh yeah, I quit doing drugs. I took up surfing. And it's so great. And then like a second later, they'll cut to Kirk on his ranch that he owns. Or he's like somewhere in like somewhere in a wooded area. And he has like horses and he's wearing a cowboy hat because he has a ranch somewhere. And then it'll like cut, like it just keeps cutting back to them doing insane shit. Like when Lars is talking about maturing, his idea of maturing is that like, I've been collecting these paintings, and like his version of collecting paintings is like, he's got Basquiat's and he's got Pollock's. Like, he's got like all this super expensive stuff.
Yeah. He's like, literally reclining on his couch in front of a Basquiat and he's musing about the artistic process. And he's like, why did he put these gold bits here? And he didn't put any up here in this black area.
Yeah, he's like so amazed by it with like, he's like, how did he know to stop here? And why didn't he put any up there in the black space? Why? How did he do it? And it's just like, I don't know. He was a really good painter. He's like painted a thing, man. But he's like, it's incredible. But like his idea of maturing is like, because there's this kind of narrative that he has of like having to put childish stuff behind and move ahead. And in his version of the world, that's auctioning off these like $1 million+ paintings at Christie's so that like him and his wife can buy another mansion. Like that's yeah. like growing up. He's like, time to start a new phase of my life. And then it's got them like up in a, like a little private room at the auction house where like this Basquiat painting's going for like $3 million.
$5 million.
It was like some like record setting thing. He's like, oh, they're like cheering. He's like, it's like, yeah, I mean, I guess this is.
And that wasn't the only painting that was millions of dollars.
No.
It's like multiple $1 million paintings and $600,000 paintings. And yeah, I can't even.
His collection. But yeah,
he has a child's understanding of art.
I think in his head, he thought that was a relatable moment. And it's like, nothing about this is relatable, dude, at all. And like Kirk in his private ranch, like, no, like. None of this stuff is relatable. And also, James Hetfield goes on vacation to the most psycho rich guy vacation ever, where he goes to Russia to hunt bears. And he's like, he's like incommunicado for like a month because he's holed up in Russia shooting bears. Like, that's like as close as you can get to the most dangerous game.
Yes, it is. Yeah.
While not being like.
Not going over the line.
Yeah, without going over the line. Like, who goes to Russia to hunt bears? And then they're sitting around the table talking, like, could you eat him? He's like, no, they just got done hibernating. So it's like, why would you kill them?
I don't know.
That's horrifying.
It is.
But that's like, they're on that level of rich guy. Like, when you are traveling across the world to go big game hunting, you have completely entered the unrelatable rich guy world. Mm-hmm. And that's all of them. And I think based on the way that they're talking, I think that they still believe at this point that they're relatable guys.
Yeah.
There's like such a mismatch between how they actually come across versus how they think they're coming across, which is, I think, the reason that the documentary ends up so insane, because I really do believe that they thought this was going to be like, hey, an intimate look at Metallica. They're just some normal guys writing a record. And it's like, dude, you're shooting bears in Russia. Like, what? Your painting collection is worth millions of dollars. You're not normal guys anymore. So I enjoyed just the spectacle of just like how over the top and unrelatable these guys are. Because clearly they all have big egos at this point. Like they're I mean, you don't really get a good sense of Newstead because he bails and Kirk's kind of chill, but Lars and James are kind of the...
They both have huge, huge egos. I think one of the most interesting scenes was when there's a point where you get to see Lars's dad.
Lars's dad is the coolest guy in this whole thing.
I think, what is his name? Is his name Thorben or Thorsten or something?
He actually just released a record like last year of him doing like spoken word over like experimental cello stuff. Torben Ulrich. Who, side note, he's one of those guys where if you go to his Wikipedia page, he's done like absolutely everything. Like, he was a pro tennis player and a jazz musician. Like, he's done like a million different things.
Right. He went from pro tennis player to like writing for jazz magazines to becoming a jazz musician. To becoming a visual artist.
Yeah. Made films as a filmmaker at some point. Like, he's done everything. But at the point that this documentary takes place, and also, I mean, still now, like, same look, he's got that very, like, if you were making somebody up to look like Rasputin in a film, like, long beard and that, like, very particular, like, medieval European haircut with, like, the bangs that just kind of go straight down.
Yeah.
Like, but, like, gray all over, just like completely looks like a wizard, just like
he does. Yeah,
cool as hell look.
Yeah.
So Lars and his dad and the therapist are outside and they're kind of talking, and he's talking about like, oh, there's some stuff I wouldn't say to my dad. But then they cut to his dad in the studio with him, and honestly, he's kind of the only guy in this entire documentary that doesn't pull his punches.
Yeah, they play a song for him, and his reaction, what does he say? He says,
I'm trying to remember exactly.
I would delete
that. I would delete that. Yeah. He's very much like, because he says to the, I mean, to the effect of like, you like, cause he says Metallica is an important band. Like, you know, in the history of music, it's like, mm-hmm. you know, this happens and this happens and this happens, you know, then it's like, you know, the Beatles happen and then like Led Zeppelin happens. And then, you know, Metallica is in that chain of like important big bands. And like, there's like a legacy and a reputation here. And he basically says like, I know that you guys are better than this record you're putting together. Like, this is not yeah. worthy of the Metallica name. He's the only one in this entire documentary who says it like it is, which is that the tracks just aren't good.
Yeah. And like Lars says, the song that he just played for his dad, he said they played it for their manager and their manager was like, this should open the record.
Yeah. Well, I mean, cause like that scene where he's sitting there Lars is sitting there in the studio with the manager who's like, people are going to be like Metallica. And it's like, clearly the manager does not have a very objective perspective on this. Clearly mm-hmm. Bob Rock doesn't. Like,
yeah.
Lars's dad is the only one who's actually like listening and being honest about the fact that these tracks aren't good. They're like meandering. Mm-hmm. I mean, cause like the whole way the record was constructed was they just got in a studio and they dicked around. Like the reason that everybody shit talks Aimless Jam Sessions is that it's just, that's all they are. There's no point to them. So like all the St. Anger stuff is just like monotonous because
yeah.
it was born from just going into a studio and being like, durna, oh, here's a riff. Durna, durna, durna. And like, yeah, we'll make something out of it later, which it's not like,
and there are no solos to break it up.
No solos. Yeah. So it sounds like a monotonous jam session because that's what it was. And yeah, Lars's dad is like, if this was me, I would delete it. Which, I mean, they really should. They should have yeah. listened to Torben. He was the only real straight shooter here. You want to talk about the Mustaine?
Oh, right. Bit? Yeah. They sit down. Lars, I think this is when James is still in rehab.
Yeah, it's just Lars, the therapist.
And Lars, the therapist, Phil, they sit down with Dave Mustaine, I guess to, I don't know if I would say patch things up, but kind of hash out their history.
Yeah, which for anybody who isn't aware of the Metallica Mega, which honestly, like, I've always known that, like, I've always vaguely known, but like not really known the specifics, but Mustaine was the original lead guitarist in Metallica, and he actually co-wrote, he has a couple writing credits on their very first record, but he was kind of I think he was just drunk all the time. He was an alcoholic, mm-hmm. and I think he had some anger issues and like would, I don't know, I guess they got into some scuffles or something, but the band kicks him out and then they get Kirk to be the new lead guitarist. And there's always been animosity there because like there was like a big rivalry between Metallica, and Dave Mustaine would go on to form Megadeth, which was also, you know, fairly successful, but there's always yeah. kind of been a rivalry between like Metallica and Megadeth. So, so they get Dave Mustaine into the room for a therapy session.
Yes. And he's like, do you know what it's like to be me? And he says people on the street will shout Metallica at him.
Yeah, he's just been like, he's been tormented like since he's been kicked out by like people just trolling him for.
Yeah. Kind of being like the number two.
Yeah. He's like, I know, he's like, everything I do, I fail. And I know for a lot of people, you know, my failure would be like a success. And I was like, I mean, selling 15 million records, I'd take it. Like,
I would take being in Megadeth. Yeah.
I'd take being number two, but he's like really just like opening up about like how he wished that the other guys in Metallica had just like, I guess like sat him down and be like, I guess like had a come to Jesus moment with him of like
an intervention.
Yeah, because he said that like he wished they would just been like, you need to go to AA, dude. Because I guess,
which, like, honestly, I think it is hard to imagine them not doing that. If not saying literally AA, but saying like, hey, you can't be drunk all the time. Like, I would be surprised if they didn't honestly discuss that. And, you know.
Yeah. Well, but I mean, also, like, I'm pretty sure Hetfield was drunk all the time. Like.
Yeah, I mean, I guess that's the other thing is if you are an alcoholic, it's hard to say you're an alcoholic, man, to another guy.
And they were all super young because, like, yeah. Cliff Burton died before, I think their second, before, was the second record? I mean, because Cliff Burton was 24 when he died. Mm-hmm. And they were already like a fairly successful band at that point. Like they were, when they were starting out, they were like very young. So, and you know, based on some of the stuff Lars said, I also don't know necessarily if they were emotionally equipped to like know how to handle things. Like I think that probably at that age and level, they're like, yeah, let's just kick him out and get a new guy.
Yeah.
Like just kind of like change the locks and don't tell them. And
yeah, there is a point where Lars says that he would drink 42 beers with Hetfield in order, like, and at the end of that, Hetfield would finally be like, I love you, man.
Yeah, he has this moment where he says that, like, when they like when they just met, like when they were like little kids, there's like a photo of them like really young. They would just like, you know, hang out together and like listen to, you know, new wave of British heavy metal records, and they were like friends. But the moment that like anybody else enters the scene, that like connection they had kind of goes away. Like there's this inability to be like vulnerable or intimate with each other if there's anybody else there. And so, yeah, Lars is like, we've never had that unless we're both completely shit faced, then like, you know, there's that moment that can come through. Just like very, I don't know. It's weirdly genuine and revealing in the context of most of the rest of this documentary. I'm going to go ahead and say like the therapy is like largely just bullshit. I think it's very much like rich guy ego massaging, but the Lars, I don't know, some of the stuff with like Lars, and it doesn't feel like James really addresses it as much, but you can tell Lars is like very hurt by the fact that he doesn't have like that kind of access to the vulnerability that he knows is there with this guy that like basically was his best friend.
Yeah.
So I thought that was interesting and revealing. And also it is very much like a lot of cliches about male repressing emotion therapy stuff. Like it's very much on brand for all the cliches about, you know,
men would rather
record Saint Anger than go to therapy. Although they do go to therapy.
To therapy of a sort. I don't know how useful it is really, but
honestly, Phil seems like he is in it to massage egos and collect his big fucking paycheck.
Yeah, I respect the hell out of that. I am very jealous of Phil.
What was the figure Lars gives for how much they're paying him?
$40,000 a month.
Yeah, like,
and they did this process lasted over 2 years.
Yeah, they're like maybe we should. Well, then there's a moment where Lars is like, yeah, we're thinking about cutting Phil back to like maybe every other week, and then we did that, and then we're like, no, we need Phil here all the time. So my dude is just collecting $40,000 a month to just be like, I'm trying to remember some of the stuff they talk about. Some of it's just like really like just super basic shit about like how they're working together. Like just like stuff that is not stuff that is not like galaxy brain elite.
You shouldn't need to pay someone $40,000 a month to tell you that stuff. But
some of it is just like him just being like, well, rather than fighting about it, why don't you just like take a simple vote? Like just like very basic, getting along with people you're working with stuff.
But he made probably over $1 million off of this, which is great. Honestly, he deserved like it. I'm not saying he doesn't deserve it because like, can you imagine sitting there in that room for like 8 hours a day?
It would have been, I mean, imagine some kind of monster, but it lasts for years.
Yeah. And like, I can't imagine that these rich guys have any boundaries. So I imagine you're also getting phone calls at midnight from Lars.
All I know is that Lars said it was recommended by another Q Prime artist, but apparently Q Prime manages like absolutely everybody. So it's hard to say. However, I know it's not Red Hot Chili Peppers, but I'm choosing to believe that Red Hot Chili Peppers had therapy.
There's a point near the end where you can see that they're getting kind of anxious about the fact that they're still paying the therapist to hang out with them all the time. And they're like, how long is this going to keep going on? And Hetfield is kind of like, does Phil think he's in the band now? He's talking about moving out here. And they kind of sit Phil down and they have this like very awkward discussion with him about whether he, like, how long he expects to be giving them therapy, and whether he's going to move out there or not.
Yeah. I mean, I think that they should have let Phil in. I think they should have made him a member. He should have been like in the band promo shoots, just like Phil with like a, with like an Argyle sweater. Do we feel like they've made any emotional progress through the course of it? I don't think that they really, I don't think any of them, it doesn't seem like it.
I think they did. They seem to be working together better near the end, but
I don't think that, I don't know if that's the therapy though.
Right. I don't know if it's the therapy or if it's because they hired a bassist, but yeah, they do seem to be getting along a bit better near the end. Yeah. I don't know if they really learned that much from the therapy, because I think you can't, I mean, I'm sure they learned some, you know, better dynamics for working together, but there is a huge limit on what you can do when your client is so rich and is paying you $40,000 a month. Like, you can't really say, hey, you guys are egomaniacs. Like,
there's also a lot of like when Lars and James start bickering of like, I'm hearing a lot of you saying that like, this is what I feel, but what I'm trying to place it as is like, what does the effect have on the group? Like, a lot of like them using therapy language, but I'm like, I don't know if like this is really productive.
Right. It's like, maybe they're not yelling at each other and that's good, or they're not storming out and that's good, but it doesn't really mean they're actually like, if you're using the language of therapy as the way to express the same
argument
or the same sentiment, I don't know if you're actually moving forward with the problem.
There's also the great scene later on where they're like sitting around the table and Lars is like, fuck.
Yeah.
And he gets like right up in James's face. He's like, fuck.
Yeah.
Which I thought was probably a good result of therapy. Should we talk about the bassist hunt? Because that's kind of the climax of the film, which is kind of the turning point where it sort of gets optimistic, I guess.
Yeah.
So the way the documentary ends is like the band went on their world tour and Saint Anger went on to be number one. And it's like a very much like everything worked out as
intended. Yeah.
Even though, like, I mean, critically, I don't know. I can't like, sure, Saint Anger sold a bunch, but I can't really see it as a victory artistically.
Yeah.
They're like wrapping up the recording sessions, I guess I will say one more thing on the note is that a lot of the lyrical content on the album is kind of pulled from, they come up with it after James gets back from rehab. So a lot of it is very much like dealing with anger and dealing with personal demons. And like, it's very much like themed around that kind of stuff. So they finish that up and they're finally like, okay, the record's done, so we're going to have to go on tour. Now, you know, 2 years later, we have to address the fact that we don't have a bassist. So they hold auditions. They have a couple guys come around they say that they're looking for somebody in kind of the same age group as them. So they have like people who've played with like the guy who was like the bassist for the Cult and like,
yeah, everybody, you know, they audition is like somebody.
Everybody who's like played in any kind of like heavy band at some point, that's like kind of in the same age bracket, was trying out. And so pretty uncomplicatedly, you know, Robert Trujillo plays. And they're like, oh shit, this guy's really good, let's get him in Metallica. And then he joins Metallica. And
yeah, I think he's a clear front runner. Like, before you know who they pick, like,
I mean, I think everyone knows.
No, I know. But I, if you were watching this in 2000, I don't know, whatever. Yeah. And you don't know anything about Metallica, you don't know who they picked, then you would, he's the clear front runner.
Yeah. Like,
he's obviously the best fit.
And the band is obviously very like, they're excited, they're
about stoked about him. Yeah,
they're like oh, we play better with him. And then Lars is like, oh, we play better when he's with us. And then, you know, Kirk was saying that there was some bass part that, like, because a lot of the guys were playing with picks, and like Jason Newsted played with a pick, but going back to the early days, Cliff Burton played with his fingers.
Yeah.
You know, and then, so, you know, Trujillo plays with his fingers too. And then Kirk Hammett was blown away. He's like, playing with his fingers. Like, you know, no one's played that song that way since Cliff. Like, so they're all like, they all have like this reverence for like, he's very talented, and he's kind of, we haven't had this kind of vibe since Cliff was with us. Which actually, after I watched this the first time, I looked into it, and maybe not material wise, but I think that a lot of people, a lot of Metallica fans consider him like technically the best bassist they've had.
Right.
Because he's very good.
He is. Yeah.
Like doesn't play the sort of stuff that I like, but he's like very talented. Like he's
you can't deny his talent.
Very talented. And so they scoop him up. And that was funny. I do think that the band handled his induction into the band very well. Because like they were sitting down with like I forget who, like a lawyer who was like, okay, and so you know, your points will increase over time, but right now like you have 5 points, everybody else in the band is like 32 points, so when they're doing votes, blah blah blah. And Lars is basically like, you know, fuck that. He's in the band, everybody gets one vote, there's four of us. If we need a tiebreaker, it goes to management. Like fuck this like weird tier system. Because they're very upfront about like, We don't want a hired gun. Like, we want to find a permanent member.
Right.
So like, whoever we pick, we want them to feel like they're part of this and they will be with us long term. I don't know. I thought they handled that pretty well. You know, Trujillo's in. He gets, you know, an equal say and all the stuff. Kind of.
Right, yeah, I really respected them for that. Actually,
they give him $1 million advance up front. They're like, you know, this will, you know, make you a little, you know, this will give you a little pep in your step while you're learning the songs and stuff. Because you know you're in Metallica now. There's a really funny part though, where when the lawyer's going over stuff, and he's like, yeah. And so this is, you know, this point going forward, you know. So he's like, so all the documentary stuff like doesn't affect you. That's on these three. That's their, you know. So none of the financials of that affect you. And Lars has the thing of like, oh, what'd you do with your money? Like, oh yeah, I bought a new car. I bought my mom a house. And like, would you buy a documentary? And it's like, yeah. I mean. Yeah, the three older members are saddled with some kind of monster, and Trujillo doesn't have to deal with that at all.
Yeah, when he comes in, it does feel like the band is a different band now. Like they all seem happier, they all seem to get along better, and I don't know if it's just like the thing where you are on your best behavior because there's kind of a new guy.
I mean, I think it's probably a combination of all those, because like somebody new who's like pushing you because they're very talented and they're inspiring you, that'll make you play better. You know, somebody new will be on your best behavior. So, I mean, honestly, I'm still gonna say if they had just scrapped the St. Anger stuff, started fresh with Trujillo, recorded more like properly, like together, like it would have been a better album.
Yeah, probably. Yeah.
Because, like I said, people say that there's a recording of them just together playing through the album, and it sounds better. Trujillo's on bass, and
and then like maybe just as a footnote, I thought it was kind of interesting that like Trujillo is playing for Ozzy, and then he gets hired by Metallica, and then Ozzy hired Jason Newsted.
Yeah, they flash up a photo of like some bass magazine cover, and it's like. It's like switching sides. It's like Ozzy scoops Newsted or something. I don't know. I guess Newsted has claimed that like he's been fine with it. He's played with a couple other people. I don't know. Maybe he is. Maybe he isn't.
I don't know if I would feel truly fine personally. But then, I don't know. Maybe he wasn't very like he obviously wasn't very happy working with them. So.
I mean, from what the documentary reveals about it, it doesn't seem like it was particularly fun to be in that band at that time.
Yeah.
So I don't know.
It's kind of that thing where if I were in his shoes, I think I would feel like when a person sees their ex really get their shit together and you're kind of like, okay, great for you, but like you couldn't do that when I was there, that kind of feeling.
Yeah.
Like when you were still in the band, Hetfield's still an alcoholic, and you know that's wreaking whatever kind of havoc it does on the band, and you're kind of like, I don't know, no one's getting along. Like, yeah, I would be kind of mad that suddenly like you left, they get a new bass player, and like they're so happy together.
Yeah, I mean, however, Saint Anger comes out, and then there's a 5-year gap, and then Death Magnetic comes out, so I don't know if I would. Death Magnetic is also 75 minutes. Can these guys do fucking anything that's under 75 minutes?
No.
Why does every album need to be this long? There's a whole section on the Death Magnetic wiki about compression that has, I'm sending you an image, the The bottom is the special edition Guitar Hero one that they use, and the top is the CD release for as far as how compressed it is.
Oh my god.
Yeah, that's like the I think probably the worst that has ever been. Oh, okay, this is very much a side note, but there's some Chili Peppers fan that is so obsessive that he has like run all the Chili Peppers albums that are like disgustingly loud through a lot of like algorithmic declipping stuff and like all this stuff to like introduce dynamic back to like create a new mix that isn't compressed to shit. That like I don't even know the process you go through, but like there's a whole series of like all the Chili Peppers records that this guy is like meticulously like deconstructed and reconstructed. Wow. Which I don't know if I'd go through that much effort, but that's another the two bands that I always think of as loudness war casualties are Red Hot Chili Peppers and Metallica from this era.
Yeah,
because Death Magnetic and I think that Stadium Arcadium are like the two that are like those were the ones where people started like posting pictures of the waveform like we need to stop doing this because this is unlistenable,
right?
And then. Weirdly enough, streaming kind of killed that off because streaming platforms, they were like, hey, actually, we're just going to do a thing where we just play everything at the same volume. So if your stuff's really compressed, it's just going to sound bad, but it's not going to be any louder. So
right.
Nobody does it anymore, thankfully.
Yeah.
Metallica were fuck. The thing is, like, I'm not even going to pretend like I'm going to sit through Death Magnetic, but
yeah, I'm not either.
Fuck. And that's only 10 tracks long and 75 minutes. There's an instrumental called Suicide and Redemption that's 10 minutes long. The Judas Kiss, 8 minutes. All Nightmare Long. The Day That Never Comes, these are both 8 minutes. The End of the Line, 8. Like, every song, like, you don't have to write an 8-minute song, dudes.
What if Metallica had an album that was one song? That was an hour long.
I don't think they could pull that off. definitely would not. Would not take us to a riff-filled land. I'll agree that. Yeah, this shit, like, I don't know. I mean, the thing is, like, okay, you're going to write 8-minute long songs, fine. Do it like Ride the Lightning, where it's like 8 tracks, 45 minutes. Like, sure, fine, do that.
Yeah.
Like, you don't have to do 11 tracks. Like, they have to, like, put as many tracks on there to get it to 75 minutes, which there's very few records that can withstand being that long and being good. Very few. But yeah, so I don't know. Maybe Newsted was like, maybe he was spinning Death Magnetic and like, ah, it's good that I left this band. Yeah. Fuck this. I'm gonna go back. I'm gonna look longingly at the one Echo Brain LP and think about what could have been. Echo Brain lasted from 2000 to 2005.
I wonder if Dave Mustaine feels better now too.
I don't know.
Do you feel better after listening to Saint Anger and watching this documentary?
I don't know if better is the word I would use.
I think Get Back is still in my mind, and it's kind of interesting to compare the two, because when you're watching Get Back, you're like, whoa, he just like wrote Get Back.
Like, whoa, he just wrote Invisible Kid.
Yeah. You're watching this and you're like, okay.
Doing the, doing Leo pointing because he's writing Frantic. He's Frantic, tick, tick, tock, tick, tock, tick, tock, tick. Oh, wait, what was that? What was that horrible one that like, What was the chorus to the Shoot Me song?
Oh shit, I don't remember. It was really bad.
And there's a whole part where they're like, I wash your back so you don't stab. I wash your back so you don't stab mine.
Oh right, that was we didn't talk about that, but that was when they
were pissed off at having to do radio spot.
Radio company was trying to get them to do a spot for a contest, and they were all like, this is corny bullshit.
You're listening to KTRS, and this is Metallica. Say you can win big bucks if you call in. And they're like, why? And Lars is like, why do we have to do this bullshit? And they're like, well, because you want them to play your record. It's all part of the game. And they're like, let's write a song about it. Like, yeah, I gotta wash your back. Yeah, he's like, yo, wash your back. So you wash my. Oh no, so you don't stab mine. Yeah, and like, that's like kind of the level of juvenile that all the lyrics are on, where they're like. Where it's like, yeah, you're rich dudes. Like, just do a fucking radio spot. You know what you're like, you know the game, but they're like, yeah, this is an injustice. You don't stab my back by not playing the record. my absolute least favorite part of Saint Anger is that part that I sent you the timestamp to. Shoot me again. I ain't dead yet. Shoot me again. I ain't dead yet. That goes on for like 30 seconds. Come on, shoot me again. I ain't dead yet. All the shots I take. Shoot me again. I ain't dead yet. Fuck. So that stands out as my least favorite minute of a 75-minute terrible record. But I don't know if Mustaine feels any better. I don't actually know.
Their lyrics remind me of Kyle's Party Down lyrics. Yeah. Like Shakespeare said, I doff.
Yeah, it really is like that level of wordplay. Could you stain me like Shakespeare said, I doff? Like power. Metallica would have been better if they were a power emo band. Okay, that's another thing. I know we talked about it before. We have to find some way where we talk about Party Down. I do a Party Down episode.
Maybe I don't know what the concept. Maybe season 3. I don't know.
Yeah, maybe season 3. We'll get into the shows that we talk about all the time, because Party Down is an all timer. Shoot me again. I ain't dead yet. Like, there's no. How did a producer let that? Like, how did a producer let that happen? Though, that's my ultimate question here. But how did that happen?
I don't know.
It shouldn't have happened.
I think you get to a point where you're Bob Rock, and I think you're also a weird out of touch rich guy. And
yeah, just I mean, he also produces like 311. So I mean,
right. So yeah, I think when you produce 311, you get out of the studio with 311, then you're in the studio with Metallica, and you're like, yeah, this does rock.
Maybe that's why there's a song on Saint Anger that's called Sweet Amber. Maybe he was like, every band needs an Amber song. What if whatever the topic of Sweet Amber is also about the energy of whoever is in the 311 song Amber? What if it's all part of an extended universe? I've honestly never listened to Megadeth, so I don't know. Have you ever listened to Megadeth?
No, not really, honestly.
In my head, I always think of Megadeth as sounding like Metallica, but people don't like them as much.
But, I should. I don't know. I never really... The truth is, I never really was into metal, and I like doom metal now, but that's kind of it. My dad listened to the Black Album, so I listened to the Black Album. But yeah, I didn't even really get into... I didn't try listening to Metallica's, you know...
None of my parents were going to listen to Metallica. And then my young years were like British Invasion, and like it mm-hmm. bypassed the whole Metallica thing. So yeah, I never listened to, I don't know. I mean, I guess I could look up some Mustaine interviews since then to see like how he felt about the documentary or something. But like, I mean, like he said, his failure is success for anybody else. Cause I mean, he's been successful in his own right. So maybe I'll put a Megadeth album on. I can't imagine I'm going to enjoy. I just, that whole like, whatever that like sort of commercial thrash sound is, I just don't gel with it.
Yeah.
Sonically, a bunch of stuff that I don't like. And I don't like whatever you would classify the Hetfield style of singing. I don't like that either.
Yeah.
Shoot me again. I like where's my growl.
It's kind of growling, but.
I mean, throughout the documentary, he's wearing a lot of like Orange County Chopper shirts.
Yeah, yeah.
West, and it's very West much Coast like
Chopper.
Yeah. If you took that style of motorcycle and translated it into a style of vocal, that would be what the vocal style is like.
He does drive around on, at the beginning of this, the corniest little, weird little
fucking hot rod. Like a Rat Fink style, like open top little hot rod.
It's just, I don't know what to say about that. If his little helmet on. It is so middle-aged, like it's a certain kind of middle-aged dad. And I think it's kind of cute that you can be like the richest dad and you still end up being that guy.
Well, that was part of the weird rich guy montage where he's like riding around. And he's like,
it's weird to be a rich guy.
It's weird to be famous. It's weird to be famous. Like you get attention, but I guess on some level I invite it. Cause like, why am I riding around in this thing if I don't want attention? But you know, it's like, then it cuts to them going fast, happy.
He gets pulled over by a cop.
Yeah, it cuts to them going fast, and then it's just like jump cut to him being pulled over outside of the little.
And hot he's rod. Like beaming.
Yeah, he's like so happy that he got pulled over for speeding in his little
hot rod
thing. But he's like, this is, you know, I like to be noticed.
I like to go fast.
And speed's the name of the game. And oh, yeah, I guess. And before we wrap up, I did want to also address when they're sitting around the table and they're trying to come up with the name of the record and they decide on Saint Anger. Lars is like, we did it. We came up with the record that's, it sounds angry, but it's like, it's not hateful. It's from a positive place. It's like angry, but positive. No one's ever done that before. And it's like, dude, this is like 2003. Like, he's like, no one's ever made a heavy record that's not based on negative emotions. I'm like, it's 2003. People have definitely made heavy records not based on negative emotions. Like,
yeah, like a lot of people at that point have done that.
It's been going on a really long time. Like, there's entire branches of hardcore that are just devoted to like being overly positive. And like, there's a lot of really heavy music that's about that. You know, there's all kinds of, I mean, there's a whole tradition of metal that's just like about dumb shit. Like, there's metal that's just about like wizards and crap that has been going on a long time by 2003. Like, this is not a new thing. But yeah, Lars is like, it's never been done before. I'm like, I think it's been done a lot.
Yeah.
I mean, that's also probably part of the, like, the, you kind of end up in an ivory tower as Metallica of like not paying attention to anything else going on. You're like, we're the first people who've ever made a record like this.
You know, that's one thing that was kind of interesting about this is you don't really hear them talk about other music at all.
You don't really
get a sense for if they are listening to other music. I know they go, like, they go, Lars goes to watch Echo Brain, but like,
yeah,
you know, they don't really talk about stuff they're listening to. And I know some people don't like to like when they are actually working on stuff. Some people like to not listen to music.
Whenever I see photos of like classic records being recorded, like, there's a point in Get Back where, like, I think Paul McCartney has like a stack of records, and like, I think like Beggar's Banquet is in there and stuff. And like, there's photos of Jimi Hendrix in the studio, and he has like Stones records and Beatles records. Like, everybody has like a stack of LPs like there with them in the studio,
right? And like, they don't, I don't know if it's just,
it might be
that's been cut out. Maybe that's one, there's so much, this documentary is jam-packed with stuff. Maybe they just
put that in. I mean, that is the thing, because I think also the documentary, because of all the personal stuff, is less focused on
the actual nitty-gritty of making the music.
Yeah, like all that stuff that I was saying about like the actual recording process, I got that from reading about it, not from the documentary itself. So
maybe they were
having lengthy conversations about, I don't even, I mean, I don't, like, what even are the fucking musical reference points for this besides Metallica itself? Like, at that point, you're just like, our reference point is just
Metallica.
It's like, what if a garage band was, you know, getting into a garage to jam, but that band is Metallica? Yeah, like, I guess your point is you're trying to sound like Metallica, but also doing a bad job of it somehow.
Yeah.
I don't know. Yeah, do you have any other points you wanted to hit with?
I don't think so.
Some Kind of Monster.
I think, I mean, would you recommend people watch Some Kind of Monster?
Oh, yeah. Heavily recommended. Maybe, If you're a person who likes like music documentaries and stuff, like, definitely recommended. Because like I said, I love this thing and I don't like Metallica, so I think that there's enough like funny stuff in there, and there's enough, like, honestly, it's so memeable that like if you watch anything from it, like, your YouTube recommendations are just like a bunch of like 30-second clips of Lars saying weird stuff. Yeah, so yeah, I think it's great. It's a weird look at excess and the lives of artists who are well past their artistic prime but don't know it, who think that they're still relatable guys but aren't.
Yeah.
Which is the reason that I enjoy it so much, is that it's very much a look at some very out of touch rich guys who don't realize that they're making an abomination. I think from that angle, it's very much worth a watch.
Yeah. I think I would agree, although, like, I found it tried my patience a few times. I was kind of like,
What were the parts that dragged? Because the first time I watched it, I watched it, like, all the way straight through, and I was pretty captivated.
You were enthralled. I don't know. Yeah. I just, like, I got about halfway through, not even, and I was kind of like, I'm going to take a break for a little bit.
Yeah. I mean, I do that with most movies in general, Yeah. So I don't know if that's an indictment against it. The first time through, I pretty much watched it straight through just because I found it really funny. Especially because, like, I mean, Hetfield's walking around in like West Coast chopper shirts and like True Religion jeans. Like, it's just such a product of the era. And it's just very funny to me. So, yeah. Plus, I don't know. They covered so much ground. Like, going back to rewatch it, I was like, oh, this is longer than I remember it being. Because it's like a...
It's a solid 2.5 hours.
Yeah, yeah. It's close to 2.5 hours. So it is a long one, but I mean, they do pack so much in there, and it does stretch for years, and there's a whole... Because I think that, like I said, I think that there's a couple individual documentaries. You could make Our Bass Player Quit, We Have to Record Now, and We Have to Find a New Bass Player, its own thing. You could make Band Therapy its own thing. There's like so many different like mini documentaries within it. So
I think maybe I've been on a run of kind of long, disappointing movies. So I think I was...
What else were you watching that was long and disappointing?
I don't know if it was long, but we watched Deep Water, the Ben Affleck snail movie.
Yeah.
Which was not very good. In a way that wasn't like, I knew it wasn't going to be good per se.
Yeah.
But like it was less good bad than I hoped for. And then, and we watched The Batman, which is streaming now. So.
Oh, well, I've not heard your take on that yet. Very quickly. is it okay? So we were thinking it might be okay. Is it not good?
No, it's not good.
Even like Pattinson and Dano can't save it?
No. But I would still say I would watch it. Like, I think you should still watch it because it's hard to say. It's not horrible. And I think Paul Dano's really good in it. He is great, but you basically don't see him till 2/3 of the way through the movie.
So he's like how they treated Leto Joker in the original Suicide Squad, where you're like, I need the Joker, and I just don't give him to you.
Yeah. Like, there's a few scenes of him with his mask and stuff on, but then like you get a more meatier scene when he's not in it, and it's great, but like you wait so long for it, and it's really bogged down by too many villains. The problem of the classic Batman problem, too many villains, because they have like Carmine Falcone, they have Penguin.
I did not know that.
Yeah, so there's way too many fucking... There's all this boring shit of that's just like corruption in Gotham.
Why does every Batman movie feel like you have to include every bad guy?
I don't know. Yeah, that drove me nuts. Like, and Pattinson is fine, and Paul Dano's great, and Jeffrey Wright's fine too. Like, it had elements that were good, but then the actual story bogs it down. And just didn't need to be that long.
Yeah, I saw some kind of lukewarm reactions to it from people online.
Yeah, and also he has zero chemistry with Catwoman. Zero, absolute. They seem to find each other repellent on screen. Like, it just does not work at all.
Who's Catwoman in this one?
Kravitz. Zoe Kravitz.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I don't know. People keep going back to the Batman well, and it seems to be like...
I think you can go back to it. I appreciate that they don't get into his origin story. Like, they aren't doing a complete reboot where...
You know what would be good? What they should do? They should do a Spider-Man movie that reboots it and then tells Spider-Man's origin story. Because we haven't had one of those in, like, 20
years. Yes. I need to know about that kid who was bitten by a radioactive spider.
Oh, wait, is that what happens? I totally had forgotten. No one ever talks about how Spider-Man became Spider-Man, so I've forgotten.
I think you should still see The Batman because there is some stuff that's worth seeing in it. There is kind of a great scene where he wipes out and limps away, and I really appreciate seeing Batman as not a superhero.
Yeah.
Because he isn't a guy with superpowers, right? And I kind of appreciated the like small bit of humility of Batman gets injured.
Yeah, which is weirdly more than they could have spared for that horrible Watchmen movie where they made everybody superhumans for some reason. I guess the fact that I haven't sought it out yet is kind of indicative of the fact that I'm not like super, but I will track it down eventually. But yeah, I saw some reviews pour in of just from like people I know. And I'm like, I guess that no one's really, I don't think I've seen anybody I know say like, this movie is incredible. Everyone's like, it's fine. Or yeah, it's like fine to bad is mostly what I'm getting.
Yeah.
I'm like, I don't know. So I'll watch it, but probably not immediately. It'll probably be a while. Yeah. So yeah, that was a nice little detour. So I'll say, so we have a kind of a hesitant recommend, some kind of monster from you. We have a strong recommend from me. And I will say that I originally watched it because a lot of people in a music focused DM were talking about it, mm-hmm. and who had all seen it because they were Metallica fans, and they all, as Metallica fans, enjoyed it. So
right.
Okay. So I think Metallica fans would enjoy it. And also, if you are not a Metallica fan, such as myself, you might still enjoy it.
Yeah.
Because it is amusing. I can't say it offers really any insight into the creative process or anything like that, but it offers you it kind of, in a way, kind of feels like a Real Housewives version of a music documentary. Like,
yeah, that is kind of interesting about it. Yeah.
It's the closest you get to like a Real Housewives vibe when you're with a band in a studio. Because you're definitely not getting any super deep insights into like the recording process or the mind space or,
yeah,
you know, or like what decisions they were making. It's not that deep. It's very much like, oh, this expensive therapist is telling us to access our feelings. What if we write a song about how we're angry at the radio? Like it's like
a bunch of guys who hate each other in a room together.
Yeah, it's very much a dysfunctional family having to put out a product and trying to come to terms with how they're churning out what is, I mean, Saint Anger is, it's a product. It's not really a record. It's a product. Yeah. So from that angle, I think it's worth a watch. And I enjoyed it. There's a lot of pretty memorable scenes in there. So I'll give it my stamp of approval. We don't know what our next topic is going to be, but I feel like it'll probably be a band that we like. I think okay. most of the ones we were batting around were bands we like. There's a couple that are about bands we don't like.
Oh yeah, there is a couple I was very excited to do about bands or people we don't like. But
yeah, so we'll see. I mean, I don't know. Maybe we'll.
Because we gotta do Funky Monks.
Yeah, it'd be funny if we did the Chili Peppers one next. Because when we do the Chili Peppers one, which is about them recording Blood Sugar Sex Magik, I have already committed myself to listening to that album straight through.
Yeah.
Which, once again, like Metallica, there's a 9-minute song on that album that's Sir Psycho Sexy. That's a funk rap about having sex with a lady police officer for 9 minutes. And that's fucking on that record. So have fun with that.
And then I really wanted to do the Trey Anastasio documentary as well.
Oh yeah. The one where he's like older and it's like, this is the Batman of Trey Anastasio.
Yeah. It was, I think it was all about his creative process.
Yeah. Which, very, very niche content here, but I figure I learned yesterday that in 96, Trey Anastasio led a free jazz band that had some people on it, including Mark Rebo on guitar. So there's a record with one of my guitar heroes and Trey Anastasio both on a record.
One of your guitar villains.
Yeah, one of my biggest guitar heroes and one of my biggest guitar villains together on a record. Although I skimmed through it, it's very like typical free jazz, so it's like it's probably whatever. Okay. Apparently it was like a band that Trey got together that played, I think they played like twice, and then they recorded a record, and it's not like a band apart from that. It's like very much like a get a couple guys together for a couple sessions kind of jazz thing. But yeah, so I think that's about it. Yeah. Any other some kind of monster things you need?
No.
That's it for our episode. You can follow the podcast on Twitter at Turn On Your Monitor. Your is spelled YR. We post when new episodes go up. And another way to stay in the loop would be to subscribe to our podcast. We're up on all the major podcasting platforms, your Spotify and iTunes and Stitcher and all that junk. We're all over there. So subscribe to get our newest episodes when they come out. From our Twitter account, you can get to our personal accounts where we post the stuff we do. Jess has an Etsy store where she does lino cut prints of various things. Recently been very bird focused with some cool bird prints. I've got a link to my site. I've got various writing and music and stuff. Have a record that's coming out relatively soon that I'm working on. And yeah, so we're going to be, I don't know how regularly we're going to do this. I think we're going to try to keep to the old schedule, but like maybe a little bit looser. I think that maybe not, this is like very Metallica therapy ish, but I think that, I think that not making it such an obligation is a thing that helps with being burnt out on it. I think that our topic now is a little bit less inspiring for burnout.
Feels a little like, I don't know, for me, for some reason, if watching a documentary for maybe 2 hours and then just kind of jamming about it is, it feels like less of an obligation than coming up with a topic and researching a topic. And
there was also kind of the heaviness of like some of the stuff we talked about before was like very, like very doom scroll.
Right. It does spirally feel like culture, even though like our topic was just like, oh, you know, arts and culture in the digital age, but it, that feels bleak right now.
Yeah. It's like culture has fucking died on us in the year we were doing the podcast. Yeah. So
it hasn't, I don't want to be a pessimist.
It has. Okay. I'm the pessimist here, and it has.
But yeah, it felt very bleak. And I think I wasn't up to it. Like some of the things I wanted to talk about, like fast fashion is worse than ever. Like I want to die. Like
fuck Shein.
Yeah, like talking about Shein makes me want to die. So
even though
I think it is important to talk about and somebody should talk about it, but I think maybe I wasn't up to the task of talking about it.
I mean, maybe we will at some point for some reason. But yeah, a lot of the stuff was like, a lot of the stuff we were talking about was very much like the stuff that sends me on depression spirals anyway, and I'm like, I don't know. And also, like, at the same time, it's like, I don't know, is it important for me to have to talk about these issues anyway? Like, I'm fucking nobody, I'm a fucking loser, you know?
Right.
I have so little control over my own life, much less like anything important going on. But you know what I can do? I can obsess about the minutia of cultural products relating to bands from a long time ago that nobody cares about.
That is
my wheelhouse. So,
So
probably less strict, but also I think that, we'll try to get back into the swing of doing these semi-regularly.
Yeah.
I think that kind of unplanned couple month break was sort of necessary for,
I had to go to rehab like James Hetfield.
Yeah, we had to go to podcast rehab, and we had to, like, when he comes back and he's like, I can only work for 4 hours a day, and like that's kind of how we were.
That's me. Yeah, that's I can only work for 4 hours a day.
Yeah, we kind of had to go to podcasting rehab and kind of figure out what we wanted to do more. So we're running with this for a while. There's a lot of documentaries we want to talk about, and you know, both about bands we love, bands we hate, and all kinds of stuff. So you can keep up with that by subscribing and following our Twitter. All right, so that's the episode. And until next time, shoot me again, I ain't dead yet. Shoot me again, I ain't dead yet.